Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, and welcome back for another episode of my mystery series, where today we've got a mystery with a bit of a difference. This isn't an unsolved crime or an unidentified person or even a missing person anymore. This is the mystery as to whether or not we think that George Mallory and Andrew Sandy Irvine made it to the summit of Mount Everest in 1924, 29 years before Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norway became the first confirmed climbers to have done so in May 1953. Mallory and Irvine never made it back down the mountain to tell their story, and for many, many years their bodies just wouldn't be discovered, just becoming two of the many dead on Everest. I actually have already filmed a whole video on the mysteries of Mount Everest. It's a couple of years old now, but it's one of my favourite videos I've ever filmed, and from the feedback I got on it, I think it's one of your guys' favourites too. I'll leave it linked down below in case any of you are interested in watching that after this, but I had a lot of comments on that video from people outraged that I didn't mention Mallory and Irvine in that at all. In all honesty, I planned to film this video separately at the time, but for some reason it just got pushed to the back burner until now. This story really is a fascinating one. So let's begin by setting the scene here. It's 1924, no one has ever managed summit Everest before, but explorers had been able to check off some of the other furthest corners of the Earth. Both the North and South Pole had been reached, and the sources of all the major rivers had been found and explored. The summit of the world's highest mountain, Mount Everest, was deemed to be the last major corner to be explored, and it was a race as to which nation would be the first to reach the summit, and there were many, many failed attempts, year in, year out. Mount Everest is the Earth's highest mountain above sea level. It is located in the Himalayas, with the summit point finding itself at the China-Nepal border. It's 8,848.86 metres high at the tallest point, that's just over 29,000 feet, and the summit is shaped somewhat like a three-sided pyramid. The three relatively flat planes of the sides of the peak are called the faces, and the points where these faces join are known as the ridges, all of which meet at the top of the peak, the summit, the tallest point in the world. The summit and the final part of the path up to it is covered by snow, rock hard at the bottom and a softer layer of snow on top, fluctuating by about 5 to 20 feet throughout the year. As you can imagine, the snow levels and the general weather are what dictate when people are able to climb Everest, with the snow at its highest point after the monsoons in September and the lowest in May, so that means that most, if not all, Everest expeditions are planned to reach the summit around May, maybe early June. But the climate is rough no matter what time of year you go. Even in July, in summer, the average daytime temperature is minus 19 degrees Celsius, and at its coldest, you're looking at around minus 60 degrees Celsius. That's minus 2 and minus 76 degrees Fahrenheit, relatively. The risk of frostbite and hypothermia whilst you're climbing Everest is unbelievably high, and combined with the fact that oxygen up at that elevation is extremely thin, it's not really looking too good for any humans who find themselves up there. Once you reach an altitude of 8,000 metres, you've reached what they call the death zone, where oxygen levels and atmospheric pressure are almost too low for human life. Personally, climbing Everest is not something I would ever aspire to, let's put it that way. I think you've got to be a very specific kind of person to want to attempt summit Everest. Most of us simply just aren't made for that. But some people are. The Sherpa people are the true heroes of Mount Everest. They're the unsung heroes. No one really has an exact number of the amount of bodies that litter Everest. There are a lot, because once you die on Everest, there's not really any way to get your body back down. Therefore, a lot of the bodies are just used as markers for other climbers to let them know which point of the climb they've reached. We do know it's at least over 300 people, though, who have died in their summit attempts. And sadly, the majority of these are Sherpas, which is the name for both the climbing guides of Everest and the ethnic group from which the vast majority of them hail. The Sherpa people are a group native to the most mountainous regions of Nepal, native to Everest. Through centuries, millennia of evolution, their bodies have become very well suited for high altitudes, allowing for greater efficiency in the use of oxygen. This makes the Sherpa people the best people for the job for climbing Everest. And whilst hiring Sherpa is not required for climbing Everest, they very much increase the odds of you reaching the summit. However, the Sherpa people aren't immune to the pressures of the mountain. Even many of them also die. So hopefully all of that gives you just a little bit of context as to how difficult it is to climb this mountain. Even today in 2022, with all of the technology and knowledge we've gained over the years, Everest doesn't care, it will kill you. So imagine how difficult it was a century ago, especially because a lot of people believed back then that the use of supplemental oxygen was cheating. Real men don't use oxygen to climb Everest. George Mallory was born June 18, 1866 in the village of Mobley in Cheshire and went on to earn a mathematics scholarship to Winchester College. It was there that he was introduced to the sport of climbing, regularly travelling to the Alps with his mentor Graham Irving to climb. Over the coming years, Mallory would attempt some of the most difficult summits in the world before going on to serve in the British Army during World War I. But upon his return, he made it his mission to attempt Everest and joined the first British expedition in 1921. From what I can gather, they didn't necessarily intend to be able to summit Everest this time in 1921, knowing they had very little knowledge of the mountain because they were the first British team to attempt it. It was supposed to just be a reconnaissance mission to map the region and look for a viable summit route for future use. And that's pretty much what they did, finding a viable route via the northeast ridge. So the next year, Mallory then returns to Everest under a different expedition. They did bring bottled oxygen with them on this trip, but Mallory and others decided to make their attempt at the summit without it, seeing the oxygen as cheating. They managed to reach just under 27,000 feet, so about 2,000 feet still from the summit. It was an altitude world record at the time, but not enough for Mallory, it wasn't the summit. Mallory was forced to retreat back down, so a different duo then made a second attempt, this time using oxygen, and they were able to reach 27,300 feet, so definitely higher, but again they were forced to retreat. A third attempt organised by Mallory resulted in an avalanche triggered by their actions. Seven Sherpa porters ended up dying and they didn't have much choice but to end the expedition there. Mallory was devastated, but he still came back down the mountain as one of the world's leading climbers and he'd reached the second highest elevation of any human ever. But it wasn't quite good enough for him. He had now come to realise though that without the artificial aid in the form of supplemental oxygen, it's likely that no one would ever be able to summit Everest. But he was also ageing, he was in his mid-30s and thought that he would soon be too old to ever be able to make the attempt again. You had to be at peak physical fitness to do this and he felt his time was coming to an end. So in 1924, aged 37 years old, Mallory joined what he knew was going to be his last expedition ever, his last attempt at Everest. Famously, the year previously, when asked by a New York Times reporter why he was so determined to reach the peak, he said the immortal words, "Because it's there." The full quote was actually, "Because it's there. Everest is the highest mountain in the world and no man has reached its summit. Its existence is a challenge." The answer is instinctive, a part, I suppose, of man's desire to conquer the universe. To me personally, it just speaks of humanity's stubbornness, humanity's desire to prove itself for whatever reason. I do feel there's a lot of ethical questions to be considered around people's desire to climb Everest, but none of those questions would have been considered in 1924, of course. Mallory and many others just wanted to do it to prove they could, because it's there. The 1924 expedition was led by General Charles Bruce and Lieutenant Colonel Edward Norton, not the actor, both of whom Mallory had made attempts with before. However, shortly before they were due to go to Everest, Bruce had a flare-up of malaria, and so George Mallory himself was promoted to climbing leader. Mallory certainly had the experience to make him a viable candidate for this. The expedition group consisted of a number of experienced mountaineers, a medical officer and a photographer, Captain John Knoll, as well as Sherpas to assist. The youngest on the climb was Andrew Sandy Irvin, who was just 22 years old and an undergraduate at Oxford University. He'd been recommended for the group by others who had seen him on other expeditions, and they thought he had the potential to be able to make it. He was young and fit and determined. Now, something else to know about Everest expeditions is that it's not just a case of quickly popping up to the summit and then coming back down in the space of a week. These expeditions are months long. You've got to very slowly allow yourself to acclimate, get used to the atmosphere and oxygen levels bit by bit. The 1924 expedition first headed to Darjeeling, a town in the East Himalayas in India, to set out their plan for the trip, before leaving on the 25th of March to head to Tibet to begin the ascent. They had to leave as late as they possibly could to try and avoid the end of the winter weather, but also it couldn't be too late because then they could run into the monsoon season at the beginning of summer towards the end of the trip. The timing had to be perfect. As expected, the first part of the journey went without any bumps in the road, apart from General Bruce getting that bout of recurrent malaria and Mallory having to take over his role, but that was all fine. All in all, it was thought that this was going to be a very strong group and they anticipated very few problems going forward. Towards the end of April, they made Everest Base Camp, but almost as soon as they arrived, the weather turned. There were blizzards and unusual snow for the time of the year, adding complications to their plan. But they were determined, and after weeks of inclement weather, a number of camps were eventually set up along the side of the mountain by 150 local Tibetan Sherpas who had been specially enlisted for this job beforehand. The Sherpas would start carrying the group's load to Camp 1 ahead of them, each person carrying 40-pound loads. Seven camps were to be established up the side of the mountain, and the last one was at 27,200 feet. And the Sherpas were to do the vast majority of the work to set the camps up, being paid 1 shilling a day plus rations. They weren't even provided tents to sleep in and were expected to just sleep out in the open. It was pretty rough. Once the 150 Sherpas reached Camp 1, 75 of them were sent back to base camp, but 52 of them never appeared. Through my research, I don't think they died, at least I couldn't find that being alluded to anywhere. I just don't think they went back, but I could be wrong on that. The 75 who remained at Camp 1 were then to continue on to set up Camp 2 and then Camp 3, but from Camp 3 onwards, setting up the camp was the job of the climbers. Behind the Sherpas, the British expedition began their journey. By the 19th of May, two of the men, Knoll and Bruce, reached Camp 1. Then Irvin and a man called Hazard reached Camp 2, and Norton, Mallory, Somerville and Odell reached Camp 3. Then the next day, Norton, Mallory and Odell reached something called the North Col, a pass carved by glaciers. But on the descent back down to Camp 3, things started to go wrong, a foreshadowing for what was to come. Maybe the men should have given up here, but you don't go onto Everest to give up. Norton had quite a nasty fall, as did the porter, whose life was only saved by a softer patch of snow. Mallory stepped into a crevasse and fell about 10 feet before his ice axe jammed into it and somehow saved his life. He managed to crawl back out of the hole, which was just a black abyss down below. From there, they had to go on to set up Camp 4 and beyond, along with 12 porters, at which they did succeed, but the weather continued to get worse. Somehow, they were still able to establish the next camps, though. By this point, it was the beginning of June already, and on the 1st of June, Mallory and Geoffrey Bruce decided to give the summit a go, but this attempt had to be aborted very quickly due to the awful weather. The next day, Edward Norton, again not the actor, and Howard Somerville decided to attempt the ascent again, following a line across the north face of the mountain. And of course, they decided they were going to try it oxygenless. One of them was forced to give up at around 28,000 feet, whilst the other continued alone for 126 feet more before having to turn back. This in itself was a record that wouldn't be exceeded for the next 29 years, maybe. At that height, they suffered with double vision, debilitating coldness and exhaustion. Norton started to suffer with snow blindness, which is eye damage from the UV rays reflecting off the snow and glaciers. The entire group was sort of moving up and down the mountain constantly between the camps in smaller groups. Whilst Norton and Somerville were making their attempt, Mallory and Bruce had gone back down to Camp 3 to see if they could figure out the logistics of taking oxygen with them on their next attempt, and they got porters to carry the oxygen up to the next camp. Irvin was the one tasked with the job of making the oxygen tanks work efficiently, because they really weren't all that reliable. A huge amount of the tanks they had with them had already experienced leaks, which is obviously no use to anyone. The next day, Mallory and Irvin climbed back up to Camp 4 using oxygen, and apparently made the climb in record time. Turns out it helps. It was at this point that Mallory and Irvin's paths crossed with Norton and Somerville after their failed attempt, and they explained that they were intending to attempt the summit next. Norton thought that Mallory should have attempted it with a more experienced climber than Irvin, but he said he wasn't about to interfere. Mallory chose Irvin for this because of his knowledge of the oxygen tanks. He was experienced in taking apart and rebuilding the rigs. He knew how to fix them if they went wrong, and they did that a lot. He had finally accepted that the only way to the summit was with the assistance of oxygen, and he wasn't about to let anything go wrong with that. Their summit attempt began on June 8th, with Mallory deciding they should take two bottles of oxygen rather than just one, a decision that he was reluctant to make because of the weight of them. There is even some evidence to suggest they might have taken even more than that. Some sources say that Irvin took three and some others say that they both took three, as we know that they had at least that many at the camp with them. Inventory suggests they had 10 bottles total at this camp. They had two empty and eight full. The night before they left for their attempt, they would have slept using half a bottle each, leaving them with six full bottles for the summit attempt. However, in the final photograph taken of the pair shortly before they left the camp, they're seen carrying only two bottles each. We don't know for certain how many they did take, but three oxygen tanks would have been a lot of extra weight. Although Irvin had managed to come up with a way to remove 5 pounds from the standard tank, the oxygen rig itself still weighed about 30 pounds, which is a lot of extra weight to carry when you're attempting such a climb. But he thought that the extra access to oxygen might speed up their climbs and maybe it was worth it. It's thought that they left Camp 6 at around 5:30 a.m. that morning. But well before they reached something called the first step, Mallory's first oxygen bottle is thought to have run out. Now, these oxygen bottles should have lasted around 4 hours, and they should have been able to reach the first step in this time, but instead it's found long before it should have run out. When oxygen bottles run out, climbers would just tend to discard of them on the mountain because they don't need to be carrying that extra weight. And it's not thought to have run out due to a leak either. So as I mentioned, this was well before something called the first step, which is the first of three large rock faces that they had to climb to reach the peak. The first step is at 27,890 feet, and the oxygen tank was found before this point, so it clearly ran out of oxygen before they reached the first step. It shouldn't have, but it did. The loss of this oxygen tank would have literally been a weight off their backs, and they perhaps would have found the following ascent just that little bit easier without it. And it's thought that they did pass the first step at around 8:30 to 9 a.m. So having passed the first step, which isn't all that difficult, they now needed to make their way to the second step. Nobody quite knows the exact route they decided to take that day. There were a couple of different options for them. They could have followed the northeast ridge straight up to the peak, but it's generally thought that that is unlikely. So instead, they probably followed the ridge crest with the looming ridge to their side. Both routes would have led to the same place though, which is the second step. Now, I'm sure their first oxygen tanks running out so quickly would have made them question things, because Irvin's also ran out, knowing they each only had 4 hours of oxygen left, if they only took two tanks each. It was likely going to take much longer than 4 hours for them to reach the summit, plus they had the even more treacherous journey back down. Before embarking on the climb, they had decided they were going to turn back at 1 p.m. regardless, otherwise it was simply going to get too dark and too dangerous on the climb down. But so far, things were looking okay, the weather was holding out for them, and they were probably still feeling strong at this point. Plus, there was the fact that Mallory had outright said that he wouldn't be coming back down the mountain unsuccessful. I think for Mallory it was a case of do it or die trying. He was a man on a mission, he was going to reach the summit. He wouldn't have turned back around. and it is known that they did continue on their journey until at least 12:50 p.m. when another one of their group spotted them in the distance climbing a rock step. Noel Odell, a geologist and climber on the expedition with them, would later report, "At 12:50, just after I had emerged from a state of jubilation at finding the first definite fossils on Everest, there was a sudden clearing of the atmosphere and the entire summit ridge and final peak of Everest were unveiled. My eyes became fixed on one tiny black spot silhouetted on a small snow crest beneath a rock step in the ridge. The black spot moved. Another black spot became apparent and moved up the snow to join the other on the crest. The first then approached the great rock step and shortly emerged at the top. The second did likewise. Then the whole fascinating vision vanished, enveloped in cloud once more." Of course, he thought that these two black spots in the distance had to be Marion Irvine. There was nobody else on that part of the mountain. He originally thought that he saw them climbing the second step, but years later, when he was told how difficult the second step was to climb by another British expedition, he changed his mind and said he must have been mistaken. It must have been the first step. He said these two black dots were moving really fast, which would have been crazy for the second step. In terms of timing, the second step does make more sense. There has never been any hard evidence found to suggest they made it past this point. And this, I suppose, is where the mystery portion of this video really comes in. Did they make it past this point? There is actually a third step as well, but it is considered to be much smaller and much easier. Had they made it past the second step, their chances of reaching the summit were pretty high. Still difficult in terms of timings and oxygen constraints, but pretty high. To this day, climbers will say that the second step poses the biggest challenge. It's composed of crumbling rock and irregular boulders, making it really, really hard to get a foothold. No climber has ever been described as climbing the second step with alacrity, as Odell described. If anybody else doesn't know what alacrity means, because I certainly didn't, it's defined as brisk and cheerful readiness. So it says that they were climbing the step quickly and briskly and they were quite happy doing so. That doesn't really match with the second step. It is possible though that teamwork made this climb possible. There is a crack on the step which is deemed wide enough to shove a boot and maybe a knee to gain leverage, as well as one boulder that can be used to launch yourself upwards. One of the leading theories is that Irvine could have helped Mallory maybe jam his ice axe into this crack and then basically push him upwards, giving him a leg up to give him enough height to grab onto the ledge at the top. We don't know if that's the case, that's the point of this video, but is it possible? Maybe. One theory to match the alacrity description could be that Mallory did make it up to the second step, up to the top, with the help of Irvine. And then he roped up the second step, made his way back down to collect Irvine, and then they climbed together using the rope. That certainly would have been much faster and easier. Maybe they'd been struggling for a while, they'd managed to rope up, and now they were going. From so far away, Odell definitely wouldn't have seen any ropes. Another theory that a lot of people believe is that Irvine helped Mallory up the second step and then let him go on alone. This was Mallory's last chance, it was his last shot at glory. It could well be that Mallory took Irvine's oxygen tank after the 3 hours he had left of his own and set off on the journey alone. Irvine was either to wait at the first step in full view of each other or to head back down to Camp 6 on his own, which was considered to be a relatively safe descent. Had Mallory got over the second step, from there it would have been fairly smooth sailing. The climb to the third step is obstacle free and modern climbers today do it in about 30 minutes. And then from there it's just the final trek to the summit. If he made it over the second step and his oxygen held out, probably only possible if he did have Irvine's oxygen as well, then there is a good chance that he made it to the summit. But we don't know if this did happen because after Odell saw the two figures in the distance not long after midday, they disappeared. They never came back to camp and it was assumed they died on the mountain, either late on the 8th of June or early on the 9th. Neither of their bodies were found for many, many years and along with their disappearances came the age-old question. Did they manage to reach the summit 29 years before Norgay and Hillary did it? Did they even manage to get past the first step? Apart from Odell's testimony that he thought they were on the second step, there's no other evidence to suggest they even made it that far. So what is the evidence we have for sure here? In 1933, another British expedition recovered Irvine's ice axe from a spot just below the ridge and before the first step. Some say that the ice axe lay as if it had been left there intentionally, it hadn't been dropped, as it was found just lying flat on a slab of rock. It wasn't wedged in a crack or lying at an odd angle. However, others say there's no way of knowing if it had been left there intentionally. The area in which it was found is fairly smooth, so even if it had been dropped, it wouldn't have necessarily slid down anywhere. It could have just been dropped in that position. But the topography of this area makes it a very unlikely place for Irvine to slip and fall. Like I said, it was relatively smooth. So it's not like he's tripped and then dropped his axe and then fell off the mountain. It's possible, but not all that likely. So the theory is that Irvine intentionally abandoned his ice axe here, but why would he have done that to an essential part of a climber's toolkit? He must have known that he'd be at a disadvantage without it, but then again he was a relatively inexperienced climber compared to the rest of the men in this group. Also, he might have known that ahead of him the snow was much more sparse, you were dealing with more rocky surfaces than ice. Perhaps he placed the axe in this spot intending to come back and pick it up, but he never got the opportunity. Would he have made it past the second step without his axe? It's incredibly unlikely. Actually, for a really long time, there was question over whether this axe belonged to Mallory or Irvine, but a couple of decades after it had been found, a mark was found on a military swagger stick that belonged to Irvine that almost exactly matched the axe, which suggested this was a mark that Irvine would put on his belongings to identify them. So it has been assumed since then that this ice axe was definitely Irvine's. The ice axe is interesting, but it doesn't really provide any answers in itself, which is where the next piece of evidence comes into the picture, the aforementioned oxygen cylinder, marked as bottle number 9, found in 1991 in a spot about 60 metres closer to the first step than the ice axe and at a 20 metre higher elevation. This is the highest point we have solid evidence that at least one of these men reached. And there's been a lot of speculation around this oxygen bottle over the years, with many scientists analysing the question of how much oxygen the men use in this climb. And this is a vital point because, as I've already pointed out so many times, the oxygen is the decisive matter in whether or not they reach the summit. Despite what they might have thought, they would not have been able to do it without oxygen. Some people even speculate that bottle number 9 was discarded in the position it was found on the descent on their way back down the mountain after getting as far as they could. Evidence suggests that bottle number 9 would have lasted 3 hours and 40 minutes at a full flow rate of 2.2 litres per minute. If Mallory and Irvine started their climb at sunrise as planned, it suggests that this would have run out between 8:45 and 9 a.m. That's if they started using oxygen right away. But the spot where the oxygen is found is said to have been too close to the camp to have been dropped on the ascent. If it had been, it would have run out weirdly quickly. It's also a realistic possibility that they didn't turn on their oxygen until after the first step. As the website mallorynirvin.com suggests, there are 4 realistic scenarios that could be the case here in regards to the oxygen. One, that the men depart with 2 bottles of oxygen each and don't turn it on immediately, realising that the climb will take them longer than 2 bottles will last, and they save the oxygen for higher up instead. Scenario 2, they depart with 2 bottles each and go on oxygen immediately, believing they can make the summit on this. Most climbers at the time believed you only needed oxygen for the ascent, not the descent. Number 3, they could have departed with 3 bottles each and they turned it on immediately. And 4, Mallory has 2 bottles of oxygen and Irvine has 3, and he turns his extra on immediately. Mallory was stubborn, maybe he wanted to prove that he could do further with no oxygen. So what answer do those scenarios give us? Nothing, just more questions. Did they drop this oxygen bottle number 9 on the ascent or descent? Is it possible that the bottle was originally higher up, but somebody, maybe a Sherpa, has picked up and moved it further down the mountain at some point for some unknown reason? Maybe as part of a cover-up, maybe Mallory and Irvine got higher than anyone ever thought. The next biggest clue sadly came in the form of Mallory and Irvine's bodies, because they were eventually found, or at least Mallory was definitely found. The story around Irvine's body is a bit more complicated. In 1979, a man on a Japanese expedition had a conversation with a Chinese climber called Wang Hongbao, in which Wang told a story of a 1975 Chinese expedition. He said that whilst on the trip, he'd seen the body of an old British dead about 26,500 feet, laying on his side at the foot of a rock. He said he knew it was a British body because of the clothing. However, Wang would die in an avalanche the next day before anyone could get any further information out of him. Now, due to the location of this body and the fact that it was likely British, it really could have only been the body of Irvin. However, despite many searches for Irvin over the coming years, his body has never been located again. Wang said that he found this body when he left his tent at Camp 6 for a walk, and he went for 20 minutes, so 10 minutes out and 10 minutes back, and he came across this body on his journey. Surely, if you can locate the exact point that this camp was at and then walk in all directions for 10 minutes, eventually you would come across this body. Well, of course, it's not been that simple, and despite being able to pinpoint exactly where this Chinese camp was, nobody's ever found the body. Searching Everest isn't exactly easy, and this point where the camp was off the beaten trail. But there have been other sightings as well. One man called Zhu Jing, who was on a 1960 expedition, said that on his descent from the first stop, he spotted a dead climber lying on his back, feet in the air, in a hollow in the rock. However, he was in a very bad way himself and he was very disorientated. He's never been able to recall exactly where this was. Another member of that same expedition apparently also spotted something though. Wang Fu Chao was given a lecture in Leningrad in 1965, and he made a throwaway remark that they found the corpse of a European, identifying the body as so because of the fact it was wearing braces. But many people have questioned over the years why the only people to ever spot Irvin's body, potential body, were Chinese. Is there some kind of conspiracy at play? Rumours have flown over the years that Chinese climbers apparently carried Irvin's body off the mountain and now keep it under lock and key in an attempt to preserve their 1960 record-breaking ascent. Perhaps Irvin got higher than anyone ever thought. Or potentially his body has been swept away by wind or an avalanche. It's all hearsay and conspiracy at this point. This case is just mystery on top of mystery. Where is his body? Mallory's body, however, has been found, but not until many, many years later in 1999. An expedition, literally called the Mallory and Irvin Research Expedition, partially sponsored by the BBC, took place led by experienced climber Eric Simonson and Everest researcher Jochen Hemleb. The team of climbers in this expedition were from the USA, the UK and Germany, and they actually went out mainly in search of Irvin's body, using the intelligence they had from the Chinese sightings. But after one of the climbers mistakenly went off course, they ended up coming across the body of George Mallory, not Irvin. Coincidentally, Mallory was found pretty much directly below where Irvin's axe had been found all those years earlier. Now, when they first found the body, they assumed it to be Irvin's, and the number one thing they were hoping to find alongside him was a camera. Now, this camera, or actually two cameras they were looking for, is a huge point in this case. Irvin is thought to have carried at least one camera on him, a Kodak, and Mallory was definitely carrying a camera as well, as he actually had borrowed some of Elle's off him. Mallory was notoriously forgetful, so it was no surprise that he forgot to bring his camera with him. For his summit attempt, he asked to borrow Somerville so he could document the moment with photos once he made it. And that's exactly what the team were hoping to find on one of these cameras. Photos to prove whether or not they made it to the summit. I mean, there's no way they would have made it all the way to the top and then not photographed the occasion. Only, there was no camera with this body. Could someone have stolen the camera from the body over the years to hide the fact that maybe they did summit? Or did it maybe get ripped off his body during the fall? He likely would have worn it in a pouch around his neck. Or maybe Mallory gave his camera to Irvin for safekeeping and Irvin, wherever he is, has both. Mallory was actually found with blood on his clothing, I think I read on his collar. It wasn't huge amounts, but just as if he'd been like dabbing at an injury to stem the blood flow, suggesting that he'd sustained an injury before he died. Likely not an awful injury, but one that was bleeding nonetheless. Maybe he shared his load, shared his camera with Irvin just to make it a little bit easier on their journey. If he was injured and had important photos on his camera, say of him reaching the summit, he also would have had that reason to hand it over as well, knowing that if he did die on the descent, then Irvin had the photos, he had it to show people. Very quickly, the team who discovered this body realised that the name tags on the clothes read G. Lee Mallory, and other personal items found in the body also confirmed that it was definitely him. There was a pocket knife, snow goggles, a letter, and a bill for climbing equipment from a London supplier. His body was incredibly well preserved, as bodies usually are in the freezing temperatures of Everest. He was essentially mummified, and this meant they could still tell the injuries he suffered upon his death. Mallory clearly fractured his right leg, his foot was nearly broken off, and there was a puncture wound on his forehead the size of a golf ball, and it's likely that caused his death. He also had the remnants of a climbing rope tied around his waist and evidence of a rope jerk injury. So this means it's very likely Mallory and Irvin were roped together when Mallory slipped and fell, jerking his entire body. The rope would then have either snapped or Irvin would have had to have cut him loose. In the fall, he probably let go of his ice pick, which caused the injury to his head. But that wasn't all they could discern from the body. The fact that he had his snow goggles in his pocket also suggested that he fell at night, with no need for the goggles. Although, of course, he might have had two pairs on him. He might have been wearing them and had some in his pocket. So that doesn't give you a huge amount of information. But it's also very interesting what was missing from his body as well. It's been well reported that Mallory carried a photo of his wife Ruth in his pocket, a photo that he promised he would place on the summit once he reached it, putting his wife literally on top of the world. But the photograph wasn't found with the body. Could that suggest that he had made it to the summit and placed the photo there as promised? And the photo, of course, wouldn't have been found 29 years later when Norgay and Hillary made it. It would have blown away pretty quickly, probably. Unable to remove his body, the expedition simply interred Mallory where he lay, where his body remains to this very day. Mallory always said he would reach the summit or he would die trying, and it seems like he died trying, or maybe he died successfully. So I mentioned about the rope and a potential rope jerk injury. What more can we deduce from that? As I said, it looks like he would have been roped to Irvin before a fall. He started to fall and then was caught by the rope, jerked back up. This basically proves that the two didn't separate. Mallory likely didn't go ahead of Irvin to reach the summit. But if they did have only two oxygen tanks each, they didn't have any hope of reaching the summit together, which is a big point in the con column for whether or not they summited. And this also suggests that Irvin's body should also be found in this area. All known pre-World War II ascents followed pretty much the same route, so his body will be along this route or below it if he did fall. But that's of course if you believe his body is still there. Although this case does seem like an impossible one to solve, if Irvin's body is ever found, we could potentially get the answer to a lot of these questions. Chances are any camera film would have long been destroyed since then in the cold, wet climate, but Irvin's body will still provide clues, it will tell a story. So, what do the experts think? Well, they definitely think they reached the second step. They think it's possible that Mallory got up, fixed the rope, then went back down to help Irvin up as well. Working as a team, they may well have been able to scale it with alacrity. Other climbers have been able to free climb it over the years. It is possible, even if it wasn't thought to be back then. That's if you believe they even made it that far. Did they maybe make it over the step but realised if they continued to the summit it would be too dark for their descent so they turned back? Did they decide to try anyway? Do it or die trying? And then, as expected, it was too dark on the descent and they fell, roped together for safety. Until we find Irvin's body, we won't know the answers. If his body is still on the mountain though, I have all the faith that one day it will be found. Still today, people regularly go to Everest, not with the sole intention of summiting, but also solving this mystery. I do want to end this on a nice note though. On May 14th, 1995, George Mallory II, Mallory's grandson, climbed Mount Everest, scaling the second step and making it all the way to the top, where he left a photo of his grandparents. So George Mallory, the original George Mallory, definitely did make it in the end. Please let me know what you think of this case in the comments down below. Do you think they made it? Do you think they did make it past the second step? Did they even make it past the first? There's no evidence to suggest they even made it past the first step, but it was fairly easy, so they should have done. I'm just hoping and praying that one day they do find Irvin's body and that provides all the answers we need. Please don't forget to check out HelloFresh in the top line in the description box down below. Thank you so much to them for sponsoring this video, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye guys.